Christians are just stuck with history, whether they like it or not. Every Christian is a historian. It's not like we say this happened in Middle Earth. We actually say this happened, you know, in first century Middle East. People notice when you shift from saying, I believe God loves you, to I believe Jesus died under the fifth governor of Judea. The first one is something they can't test. But as soon as you say Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate, we've taken a step into the real world, and thoughtful friends who don't believe are going to say, how do you know that?
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hey there, welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. I'm Shane Rosenthal, and joining me for today's program is Dr. John Dixon, who teaches courses on the historical Jesus at the University of Sydney, and who's also a visiting academic in the Faculty of Classics at the University of Oxford. He's the author of over 15 books, including A Doubter's Guide to Jesus and The Christ Files. For the purposes of this program, we'll be talking with him about a book he released this past year titled, Is Jesus History? John Dixon, thanks for taking the time to join us today on the White Horse Inn.
Lovely to chat with you.
So before we dive into the subject of your book, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, including your background as a singer and songwriter.
Yeah, I wasn't always a nerd. My first career was singing in a band, and got to tour the world with my best mates playing music.
What was the name of the band?
In the Silence. And there's not much incriminating evidence on Spotify, but there is a little. And so I did that for 5 or 6 years full time. And I got to the point where I felt like I was pretty shallow. I mean, we were Christians in the band. It wasn't like the kind of contemporary Christian music that you guys know in the US, because that's not really that big here. So we were playing in pubs and clubs, as well as schools and prisons and universities. And we would share our faith in between songs. And it dawned on me that we were shallow. You know, we could, you know, set up and rock out, you know, a tune or two over a couple of hours. But I was giving the same message I gave in the last town. And it worried me that I'd end up shallow forever. So we disbanded. And 4 of us from the band went to theological college, which was pretty difficult, I must say. Going from playing music with your best friends to learning ancient Greek was a gear change I wasn't really prepared for.
Yeah.
And
a lot of us who took Greek had that experience, no matter what background we came from.
Well, I mean, truth be told, for that last year of being in the band, I was so worried about becoming shallow that I actually taught myself Greek with the bass player. We got a textbook that we knew lots of people used. And so backstage and in between concerts, we would be testing each other, drilling each other and parsing verbs and all that sort of thing. So when I went into theological college, I did better than I expected. And that really led me on a journey, you know, out of being a singer to being, you know, a communicator of the Christian faith and someone who takes the academic side of things seriously. And it was out of doing a degree in theology that I actually, truth be told, became more interested in history. And that's been my direction ever since.
You start off your book by saying that Christianity is unlike other religions in that it gambles its plausibility on supposed historical events. Christians, you write, don't merely say otherworldly things like heaven is open to all, but they also say things like Christ suffered under Pontius Pilate, and statements of that kind aren't immune from historical scrutiny. In fact, they touch times and places that we know quite a lot about. Why do you think this is an important point to emphasize, particularly in our day?
Well, I mean, there are two ways of looking at it. One is that Christians are just stuck with history, whether they like it or not. Every Christian is a historian, in that our principal texts, our sacred scriptures, are historical documents, and they make it clear that they are historical documents. So we have historical biographies in the case of the Gospels. We have a kind of history in the Book of Acts, and we have actual letters from human beings in our epistles section of the New Testament that are very much like Governor Pliny's letters to various friends and to the emperors. So we are stuck with history, the events that we claim at the very heart of our faith, being the life of Jesus, his teaching, his miracles, his death and resurrection. These are all allegedly historical events. It's not like we say this happened in Middle Earth. We actually say this happened, you know, in first century Middle East. So from that side, it's important. Regardless of whether a non-Christian asks any questions, Christians are stuck with history and always have been. Then when you introduce our skeptical world, yeah, it amps the whole thing up because people notice when you shift from saying, I believe God loves you, to I believe Jesus died under the fifth governor of Judea, they notice a pivot there. The first one is something they can't test. I mean, they may or may not feel that love, and they may or may not be interested in that love of God, but they certainly can't test it. But as soon as you say Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate, we've taken a step into the real world, we might say, and thoughtful friends who don't believe are going to say, how do you know that? And that's where history comes in as a useful discipline for saying, here are some things we can know about the historical dimension of the Christian faith.
Yeah, I agree with your assessment that Christianity is rooted in the claims of history, particularly, you know, since Paul says that if Christ wasn't risen, our faith is in vain. You know, but as I look across the current landscape of popular books and the sort of messages that you're likely to hear on Christian radio or television, at least in this country, more often than not, Christianity is presented as a kind of therapy. In other words, most Christians today seem to focus on their own subjective experience of the faith and have essentially left all those complicated questions about the historical Jesus for liberal college professors to sort out. Is that basically your read of the situation there in Australia?
We don't have the Christian industry that you do in America. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me when I visit the US, as I do often. You know, I'm pressing through the channels of the radio channels in my hire car, and I can hardly get away from a Christian channel. Yeah. I mean, no offense. But just give me, you know, I want news radio. I'm looking for news radio. Where's the news? So we don't experience that side of things. But the notion that Christianity is therapeutic, I think, is universal in the Western world. And it's a shining example of how, for better or worse, and often worse, Christians are influenced by the prevailing culture, the prevailing questions, and can shape their gospel in the direction of the prevailing questions of the culture. And so, you know, we live in a therapeutic culture. We live in a culture that's always asking, you know, how can this improve my life in some way? And Christians have gone, oh, we've got an answer to that. We can answer that. And they find some true things and some half-true things and some completely untrue things in our founding documents and say, here's an answer. And we take our eye off the ball. In Australia, I think one of the advantages, if I can call it that, is that we're sort of further down the post-Christian plank than America is.
Interesting.
And so we have had a lot more public skepticism for longer. I mean, I've watched what's happened in the US in the last 10 years, last 5 years in particular. And, you know, it's quite dramatic, you know, the speed at which America seems to be secularizing. But Australia's sort of been there for 20 years. And so what that means is I hope this is not my imagination, but I think Christians are a little bit more attuned, not just to the therapeutic questions, which are universal in Western culture, but to the specifically skeptical questions. When people who aren't Christians look at the Christian faith and they hear us say, oh, yeah, we've got an answer to that therapeutic question and that therapeutic question, they can see, okay, maybe Christianity can be framed as helpful, but is it true? No. And suddenly the skeptic throws us back to, is this a real thing you're talking about? And in the case of Christianity, which is quite unlike, say, Buddhism or Hinduism or even Islam, in the case of Christianity, that takes you straight back to history, to a particular time and place. We don't believe in a scripture that sort of fell out of heaven, you know, that is just the divine dictation of things God said in the heavens. We believe in, you know, actual events that have been reported by a multiplicity of witnesses. So we're once again stuck with history. It's interesting that people, you know, used to say 20 years ago in sort of apologetics circles that historical questions have gone away And, you know, we're now postmodern. And we all went, oh, okay, yeah. And of course, this was exactly the time when I was investing in doing a PhD. So I was thinking, oh, well, I'm going to be completely irrelevant forever. But they actually never went away. And I find time and time again that people who present with postmodern questions, therapeutic questions, aesthetic questions, if they find enough answers, will suddenly pivot to, but how do you know? They suddenly become modernists again.
Yeah.
Which is just a way of saying people have more questions now. They have the grab bag of modernist questions as well as the postmodern questions.
Do you think that another problem we face today, particularly with the younger generations, is that history itself is viewed with some level of suspicion? You know, the whole idea that since these things happened so long ago, who's to say what really happened?
Yeah, definitely. And this is partly a function of the decline of the study of history in our school systems, because it now seems like a foreign, not even just a foreign country, but maybe another planet. And so you might as well be doing sci-fi as doing ancient history. And that's a pivot in our culture that has had an effect, because of course, if we wound back 200 years ago, you all had to do history. Even 100 years ago, you all had to do history. And so people 100 years ago, the average sort of educated person 100 years ago, will have had a pretty good idea of Plato's Republic. They probably would have known a little about St. Augustine's view of the self. They certainly will have heard of Aquinas and his arguments for God. And that's just the average educated 20-year-old 100 years ago knew all that. They are completely foreign names now.
Right.
So two things seem to be going on at the same time. There is this sort of emphasis on the therapeutic that you've talked about that is everywhere in our culture. And so history just seems foreign to those questions. But the other is just an educational thing. We have stopped doing classical history in our countries to any real degree. And so it seems like, as I say, another planet. It seems like Middle Earth, not the Middle East. And one of the things I try to do in the book is, and I do this in my public lectures as well, is I point out that I wear a denarius, a 2,000-year-old silver coin, and I hand this out to audiences. And I say, look, you are holding something that is indisputably 2,000 years old. You can read the writing on it. You can see the images on the front and back. As you handle this coin, you are actually touching the time of Jesus. This is a coin from the time of Jesus with Tiberius's face on the front. And this was in the hands of people buying, selling, and doing disgusting things, doing beautiful things, being tossed to musicians, being given to miners in the very period in which Jesus lived. And my aim there is to cross that bridge that you mentioned, cross that chasm where people think history is like, it's too ethereal, it's not real. And suddenly when you hold a 2,000-year-old piece of silver with writing and images, you think, oh, wow, these events were once as solid as this silver coin in my fingers.
Yeah. Early on, you say that your book is an attempt to explain not only what we know about Jesus, but also how we know those things. Can you go into that a little?
Well, how we know is just the same rules of history that we would apply to Alexander the Great, to Emperor Tiberius, Pliny the Younger. The historical method that has grown up over decades essentially looks at what our primary sources are, in this case, the Gospels. And it boils down to a few things. First, you've got to know what the documents are that refer to the event and how independent they are. How many different kinds of documents do you have talking about the event? You've got to know what those documents actually say. So that means you've got to assess the manuscripts and find out if there are variants in the manuscripts. What is the more likely reading? We call that text criticism, but of course, classicists are doing this all the time as well. And once you're fairly confident, you know what's in your primary texts, and when they were written, by whom. Then you read those documents, you read their claims, you read the testimony, and you approach it with an openness to testimony, because that is fundamental to history. Almost everything we know about the ancient past comes to us in the form of testimony, ancient writings. And unless you are open to the testimony of others, you can't even take your first step in ancient history or modern history for that matter. But the most important thing is to set our story, the claims of the Gospels and so on, against the background of everything we know about the Roman Empire, about Jewish history at the very time of Jesus, about economics of the time, literary levels of the time. You try and understand absolutely everything you can about the background of this story, and then you place this story in the foreground and see if it fits. And that is the ultimate method. I mean, there are other methods that historians use. There are all these little tests, but they're just sort of on the margins. The fundamental test of history is, does this narrative fit with everything else we know of that particular time and place? Because if it doesn't fit at that broad level, we worry that we're reading something that was written in another time and place to pretend like it fitted in that time and place. But if it really does fit, if the story of Jesus really sounds like a plausible account of someone we know could really have fitted into the first half of the first century in Judea and Galilee, then we have a little more confidence in reading the testimony of the Gospels and the letters of Paul.
Along those same lines, I want you to listen to this clip from an interview we did with Richard Bauckham, and then afterwards I'll ask for your feedback.
Luke's preface to his gospel is written the way ancient historians wrote prefaces to their historical works. It uses the same kind of terminology, same kind of claims about deriving from eyewitness testimony. So I think Luke certainly expects Theophilus, the man, his patron, he writes the gospel for, to value what he's saying because of its historical credibility, because it's based in eyewitness testimony, because it fits with whatever they know about history. So I don't think early Christians would have accepted these as sheer sort of documents dropped from heaven. They would expect them to be rooted in history and written and compiled with care. The Gospels are actually full of all kinds of little detail about places and people and the religious groups and the controversies, all kinds of stuff about the historical context in which the stories take place. So that's one way of verifying, you know, that the Gospels are credible from that geographical, historical context that they claim to be about. And that, I think, is actually one of the most important historical methods of confirming testimony. You see, the term testimony, of course, implies that we can't actually verify independently everything the witness says. The whole point of a witness is they tell you something you don't know yourself. But what you can do is assess witnesses as either trustworthy or untrustworthy. And if you decide a witness is trustworthy, then you trust them. And this was the case in the ancient world. It's the case in ordinary everyday life when people tell us things, you know. If we've some reason to think they're not a reliable source, we doubt them. It's what happens in a court of law. You know, you assess which witness is really trustworthy, and then you believe what he says. So I think this truth to the context, correspondence to the historical context at the time in which the stories are set, is a key method, which I think gospel scholars have rather neglected because they've been going with that other task of, you know, trying to sort out, sort of thing the Jesus seminar, you know, mm-hmm. when they vote on each story about Jesus. You can't really do that.
So what are your thoughts about those comments from Richard Bauckham? Is that basically your approach as well?
Yeah, I mean, someone like Richard Bauckham was trained as a classicist, and I think that does make the difference there. He's got far more the classical ancient historians' approach to the figure of Jesus than the Jesus seminar he mentions there,
yeah.
who tend to be made up not of classicists, ancient historians, but of theologians. And I think that is an observable difference. And I wholeheartedly endorse what Richard Bauckham says. He is one of the most important scholars of the last generation, of this current generation, I should say, really. And the fundamental thing is you set the testimony you have, say, from Luke, against the background of everything we know from the time. And so you're looking for that correspondence between the testimony and the background sources that we have. And his point about the sort of internal trustworthiness of someone like Luke is crucial. So historians have to ask a few questions about a document like Luke, or, you know, like an author like Luke. One is this figure in a position to know the stuff they report?
Right.
Secondly, do they have the character of a good witness? That is, can you find them out, you know, exaggerating and bending the truth? Or do they have a flowery kind of approach that makes you really nervous that we're, you know, not being told the truth? And thirdly, does what they say fit with the general background? I've mentioned that. And fourthly, can you verify any little details, you know, the date of Pontius Pilate, for example? The title he went by, can that actually be verified? These are the questions you've got to ask of the text before you do that sort of more minute criteria for the historical Jesus stuff that has become very popular. And it seems to me that when you approach the Gospels this way, as testimony that you assess against the background and internally, the Gospels look very good. I mean, in the case of Luke, we can test Luke's trustworthiness with one source in particular. Most scholars agree that Luke has used Mark, the Gospel of Mark, as a source. There are some who disagree with that, but the vast majority of secular professional scholars think Luke used Mark. That means we can pick up Mark, line it up against Luke's gospel, and wherever Luke is using Mark, we can check, does he innovate or is he fair? And I think it is crystal clear that Luke is a traditionalist. He's a conservative. Luke is not in the business of speculating or innovating. He's a reliable witness to his mark and source. Now, if we can prove that that is the case in his most substantial source, Mark, it is reasonable. At least it raises our confidence to think that Luke is pretty good with his other sources as well. And we're pretty sure he had other sources. And I think we can rest pretty confident that in the case of Luke, we're in the hands of a really safe reporter of material who was certainly in a position to know this material, since we can place him in Jerusalem amidst the eyewitnesses in the late 40s AD. Now, if you are in Jerusalem within 15 years of the events, when there are still plenty of eyewitnesses around, you are certainly in a position to know this material.
Yeah, you also talk about the Gospel of John. I mean, the various geographical or even architectural details that he mentions can be verified and have been verified archaeologically. So that gives us reason to trust him in areas that we can't.
That's right, because it's like life, isn't it? If I get to know you and little bits and pieces of what you say turn out to be accurate, then I'm going to build up a general picture of you as a trustworthy person.
Yeah.
And so when you tell me something that I can't verify, I've got the bank of trustworthiness already to draw on, and I'm going to trust you. It's the same trust that we all had in our high school history teacher, those of us who had high school history teachers, or our science teachers. I mean, virtually everything most of us know about science, we know only by faith.
Yeah, go into that a little bit, because a lot of people today think that faith and science are opposed to each other. Help our listeners to understand, why does science require faith?
Well, for a lot of reasons. Faith, in its sort of original meaning, it really comes down to confidence or trust. That's the root idea of the word. The idea that it's sort of blindly accepting things without evidence is a brand new definition in the history of the world. And you can do this by opening up the Oxford English Dictionary, the big one. I don't just mean the little one, but the full on 20 volumes. You can actually date when this started to happen, when people started to use the word faith in the sort of believing things without evidence, is in the 1800s. Now, how does this relate to all forms of knowledge and science in particular? Because I have never looked through the microscope at the things biologists tell me are going on in cells. So everything I know about the nature of the cell, I got from my science teacher and from the science textbook. And I accepted it. And I found the same thing reported elsewhere. And so I built up a general confidence. So even someone like Richard Dawkins, you know, the most famous atheist, but also a very competent zoologist, even Richard Dawkins is relying on his buddies in physics to know about the speed of light, to know about the cosmic background radio waves that are detected. He's never actually gone and tested that. He's relying on the testimony in academic journals or his friends down the road in Oxford. He's relying on their testimony. He judges them to be worthwhile, valuable, trustworthy, and he believes it.
And even if he had tested it himself, he still has to have faith in his own rationality and in the reliability of sense perception. That gets more philosophical, but it makes the point.
Absolutely. I mean, yes, everything becomes about trust. And as you say, even trusting my own faculties.
Now, you also say that we're not simply brains suspended in fluid, but that our preferences and experiences play a part as we make decisions about whether something is believable or incredible. And this, you say, has significant implications for how all of us approach evidence.
Of course. So in the ancient world, it was Aristotle who made that distinction that's very famous now between logos, pathos, and ethos. And he said these are the three factors that are influencing whether anyone is persuaded about anything. So he said, when there's any doubt whatsoever, so as soon as you step outside mathematics, when you hear something and you're trying to work out whether you believe it, there is an intellectual dimension. You try and work out, is it rational? Is there good evidence? That's logos. But Aristotle said it's a fool who thinks that that's how we make decisions in life, because we're persuaded by pathos and ethos. And pathos is the kind of emotional or aesthetic dimension. Does it resonate with me? And often this is, you know, we're not even conscious of this, but right. If we like an idea, we're attracted to it, we're more likely to believe it. And thirdly, and Aristotle said this was the most important, the ethos of a thing. Does it have the character, the integrity that is trustworthy? So he said that we rely on people we regard as trustworthy more than people that we regard as untrustworthy. Now, that seems so obvious. But the insight is profound, because it means that the information I'm receiving from someone trying to tell me about something, my history teacher or science teacher or, you know, someone who's written a book on Jesus, my perception of their integrity will determine to a very large degree how I process the information they give. And Aristotle called that ethos, the character dimension of persuasion.
In a nutshell, you say that faith is not the opposite of knowledge. Trusting human testimony is fundamental both to living in the world and learning about the past. And this trust, like doubt, can be influenced by psychological and social factors just as much as by intellectual considerations.
Yes, and in a psychological frame, Jonathan Haidt from New York University has written that famous book, The Righteous Mind. And I regard it as one of the most important books of the last 10 years. If people haven't read it, they should race out to get it, where he reviews the last 30 years of psychological evidence that a lot more than logos is going on when we assess things. We are brought to our political opinions, our moral opinions, based not only on rationality, but he would say to a large extent on our emotion. Jonathan Haidt is just bringing psychological sophistication to something Aristotle said many years earlier. And in fact, you find in the New Testament as well that a key part of persuasion is ethos.
Yeah. A few years ago, I saw a documentary on the History Channel here in the States in which the host said, all the stories that we know about Jesus come to us from the Gospels, but these were written by writers with a religious agenda. So then, after he said that, he went on to ask, was there any evidence outside the Gospels that confirms that Jesus actually existed? And his conclusion was that there was only one. It was Josephus. But then he went on to show that the part where Josephus mentions Jesus was actually a forgery. What do you think about the various steps in that argument?
Well, what I can say about the way you described that is it just isn't how a secular historian approaches the figure of Jesus. You can be sure that historians would be assessing Jesus to the same degree if there was not even a scrap of Josephus or Tacitus or Pliny or anything like that mentioning Jesus, because the Gospels are treated just as first century texts like any other. The fact that they are written by Christians makes zero difference. Do we dismiss Josephus because he was a Jew, so he can't write about Jewish history because he's a Jew? Can we not rely on Tacitus because he loved Imperial Rome, or at least one tradition of Imperial Rome, and despised another? So we can't believe him on anything to do with Imperial Rome because he's a biased Roman. It becomes nuts in the end. So historians just say, okay, it's obvious the Christians wanted you to think highly of Jesus. Okay. Fortunately, in our sources, they're so open about that, that you don't have to guess what their agenda is, unlike other sources. The Gospels come right out and tell you, we think Jesus is fabulous, and I'm writing this so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. That's how Luke opens. So that's very helpful of him. He's telling us why he's writing. Okay, now we read him as someone who's coming from a perspective, just like every other source is coming from a perspective. But the idea that people who were fans of Jesus completely made up stories is one of those sort of old-fashioned ideas that was, you know, current in Rudolf Bultmann's days.
Yeah.
It's not so common to say that anymore. Very few people think, even the unique material in Luke, very few people think Luke deliberately put in a fake story. And it just simply isn't true that mainstream secular scholars think Josephus was a forgery. they think several lines in the famous passage in Book 18 of Josephus's Antiquities has been edited. So there are a few lines in what Josephus says that are edited. And you can almost hear it in the opening line, that passage. He says, at this time there was Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one can call him a man. Okay. So suddenly it looks like some copyist of Josephus's Antiquities has inserted a line correcting that he was merely a man. So it's assessments like this, sort of weighing probabilities, that lead virtually all historians today, and I'm pretty sure all of the Josephus experts, to think that Josephus really did write about Jesus, a broad account of him as a successful teacher, as a wonder worker who was executed under Pontius Pilate.
Furthermore, there's another section where Josephus mentions Jesus, in which no one disputes.
Indeed, yeah, Book 20. And he says, the one they call Christ. So, Ananus, the high priest, rounds up James and some others. And to explain who James is, he says, James, the brother of Jesus, whom they call Christos. Now, clearly, Josephus is not trying to amp anything up. This is just an account of the brutality of Ananus, the high priest, and how James got caught up in this. But it certainly corresponds with what we have in the New Testament, that Jesus had a brother called James.
So again, according to the documentary that I watched, the claim was made that outside the Gospels, there's just no evidence for Jesus apart from Josephus. But not only does that claim ignore important texts like Tacitus or Suetonius, but more importantly, it also ignores the rest of the New Testament, including, you know, the book of Acts, the letters of Peter, Paul, and others. Talk to our listeners for a moment about the importance of Paul's writings and how they can be used as evidence for the historical Jesus.
So here we have a whole collection of letters from a figure writing in the 50s to communities that have existed for 5 to 10 years before him, who are all obviously aware of the events for the 20 years prior. Now, that's fascinating, especially as Paul's not the least bit interested in laying down the story of Jesus to his audience.
Yeah, he's assuming they know certain things about him.
These are letters to people who knew it all.
Yeah.
And we know they knew it all because Paul, in passing, mentions all sorts of things and will often say, let me remind you, or as I said when I was with you. And if you count up all the things Paul mentions to these churches that he founded years before, all the things he mentions that he's already told them, you end up with a pretty large list of stuff they knew about Jesus, the historical Jesus, including, you know, just simple things like his name, that he was from the family line of David, that he had 12 disciples who were called the 12, a word or two about divorce, about love of enemy, all these things Paul mentions from Jesus, even a little reference to the missionaries Jesus sent out who ought to be supported financially. And we could go on. I mean, that is a huge area of study.
Yeah.
What did Paul know about the historical Jesus? And people have, you know, in the past argued, oh, because he says so little about it, he didn't know about a historical Jesus. It's historically tone deaf, if I may put it politely, because it's the very fact that he just throws away these things that he knows you know.
Yeah.
That makes this so important as evidence,
yeah,
as the tip of the iceberg for what disciples had to know about the historical Jesus.
One of the things that Richard Bauckham talks about that I found fascinating was just this throwaway line about foot washing that is there in his letter to Timothy that implies that the Christian community had been doing this for decades, this practice of foot washing, which the only place outside of 1 Timothy where that's mentioned is the Gospel of John, kind of indicates that what you have there in this passing reference is an affirmation that what John described was historical.
Yeah. I mean, to my mind, the most important example of all of these is Paul's actual quotation of the Last Supper tradition,
right,
that we find in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Paul cites it back to the Corinthians, not as teaching them in that moment, but as reminding them of what he himself received and what he had passed on to them. And then gives an actual quotation of Jesus, which is proof positive that disciples in being converted, even in faraway Corinth, had to learn statements of Jesus and had to know, you know, on the night he was betrayed, he took bread and he said, you know, this is my body. And
yeah,
the disciples actually knew that. Even pagan disciples had to know that. And then you turn over a few pages and there's that most famous creedal summary in 1 Corinthians 15.
Yeah, we've talked about this one quite a bit on this program, but please introduce it to our listeners.
It's the earliest of all the summaries of the Christian faith. And Paul makes clear that he received it from others and passed it on to the Corinthians. And it says that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised to life on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas and then to the 12. And that's the end of the creed. But it's a clear four-line summary of the passion narrative. You know, it's the Christos, the Messiah, died, and it was in accordance with the scriptures, and it was for sins, which takes us right to what all the Gospels say about that death as being for sins. He was buried, and then he was raised, and then he appeared to Cephas and then to the 12. Well, actually, the Gospels also have an appearance to Peter, an appearance to the lot of them. So there's a genuine historical memory here. And this is actually a topic of my academic research at the moment, the use of these early creeds in Christianity. It corresponds very closely to the pattern of teaching that we find in philosophical schools at the same time, even in a place like Corinth, where disciples of, say, the Epicurean philosophy had to learn not just actual sayings of Epicurus, but mnemonic summaries of Epicurus's teaching. We have a four-line summary of Epicurus's teaching, which is almost identical in length to this little creed in 1 Corinthians 15, and is just a bullet point summary of what Epicurus taught. And the cool thing about it is we not only have this four-line thing, we have a four-paragraph summary of those same points, and we have a 40-paragraph account of Epicurus's teaching. Hmm. So we have the full-blown thing, which is about the length of the Sermon on the Mount. We have a four-paragraph summary, which is about 200 words. And then we have a four-line summary of about 35, 40 words. And disciples had to be drilled, Epicurean disciples had to be drilled on this. Now, this is in exactly the same time Paul is going to Corinth and telling them, you've got to learn big stories and you've got to be able to quote on the night he was betrayed, Jesus took bread, etc. And you've got to be able to contract it into little mnemonics that are signs of the larger material, like that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, etc. So I think what we have here in this material is pretty good evidence that already in Paul's day and probably in the decade before, so I'd be confident saying from the 40s, we have a school classroom-like approach to learning the Jesus story amongst the first disciples. We already knew the Jews did that. So we should already expect that kind of rabbinic drilling of oral material, but it is crystal clear that pagans did the same thing.
And this isn't a disputed fact, even in radically liberal scholarship, right? I mean, the idea that 1 Corinthians 15 represents a creed that Paul himself had received. Talk about that for a moment. And how early some of these liberals think that this creed goes back to?
Well, beyond liberal, even sort of atheistic and agnostic scholars like Gerd Ludemann, Robert Funk, will say that this goes back to within a few years of the events. Because the language is so clear that Paul received this when he became a disciple. The technical language that Paul uses there is the same language we know philosophers used for passing on philosophical material, and the same language Josephus uses of what Pharisees did with their oral traditions. This is the language Paul uses for he received, he passed on. Now, we know when Paul received his material. We know when he was converted. And so he either got this material instantly upon his conversion, which would take us to maybe 31, 32 in Damascus. Or you could say he got it in 33, 34, when, according to his own testimony, he was in Jerusalem with Peter and James.
Yeah,
I think that's more likely. So I'm happy saying within about 3 or 4 years of the events themselves, Paul received this creedal tradition.
The reason I think this is important is a lot of people seem to think that while Jesus may have originally been a kind of wise sage or helpful teacher, over quite a long period of time, the views of his followers evolved to the point at which they began to think of him as a kind of God. But what you're saying is that the creedal statement we find in 1 Corinthians 15, which is recognized by conservatives and liberals alike to be from the early to mid-30s, reveals that the earliest Christian community believed that Jesus was the divine Messiah promised in the Old Testament, and that he died, was buried, and rose again from the dead.
Yeah, and the fact that it's a creed tells you that the narrative was much earlier.
Right.
And because in order for something to be put into a creed, it has to be a deliberate summary of larger blocks of material. That is the nature of a creed. It's the nature of how the Epicurean stuff work that I mentioned a moment ago, they didn't start with the four-line Tetrapharmakos and then over the years added another four paragraphs and then the 40 paragraphs. No, the 40 paragraphs were first. They were the actual sayings of Epicurus that disciples had to learn. And then they were summarized into these tiny creeds for mnemonic effect. So when you look at that creed, it says that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. That's the summary line that you're meant to know. Now, the thing is, what's it a summary of? It is clearly a summary of his messianic status. It's Christ who died. It's clearly a mnemonic summary of some kind of death account, right? He died. So they must have known how he died and some sort of conditions around that. It's already theologically interpreted.
Right.
It's on behalf of sins using sacrificial Jewish language, probably out of Isaiah 53. There's a bit of research into that. And what's more, it's in accordance with the Old Testament scriptures, which means disciples who learnt that one line had to know scriptures that pointed to an atoning death on behalf of others.
Right.
The way these creeds worked is that because they were summaries of larger blocks of material, they were important tools for teachers to be able to say which scriptures. And as disciples meant to know that. And that's just the first line. And then when you go that he was buried, I think makes perfectly clear they knew a narrative about the burial. You can work through just these deceptively simple, small statement in 1 Corinthians 15 is full of interest to the historian because of what it tells us about the didactic educational model of early Christianity.
You know, one of the missing parts of the conversation, it seems to me, is the fact that the early creed, which Paul cites here in 1 Corinthians 15, actually refers to two different kinds of witnesses. First, there are the eyewitnesses of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection, such as Cephas and the 12. But this creed also talks about, as you've mentioned, the witness of the scriptures that kind of assumes what the new converts to this faith would have studied. So that which was seen by the eyewitnesses was actually described in great detail well in advance by the Old Testament prophets, like, as you say, in Isaiah 53, which does talk about the suffering for sin and also that he would be given over to the dust of death, and then he would see light and then divide spoils in a victory celebration. So it seems like you have death, burial, resurrection all in that amazing prophecy. But this, I think, helps us to see that what we're dealing with here is something much more than just an invented tale or a weird story, but that all that the eyewitnesses are describing here in this creed is actually the fulfillment of Israel's prophetic expectation. That has power, doesn't it?
Yes. And the historian in me instantly rushes to think, wow, an 18-year-old pagan Corinthian had to learn not only this whole narrative about Jesus, they had to learn a book that was entirely foreign to them called the scriptures, called the Jewish scriptures. What a world, what an educational world that opened up to just your average 18-year-old tanner from down the road in Corinth, who's now a Christian. They have to be able to know which passages of the Old Testament pointed to these events. And what's more, not just in a proof texty way, they had to have some sort of substantial knowledge of what a Messiah was, because that's nonsensical. It's certainly not clear to a pagan living in Corinth. They had to know the background of the anointed ones. And according to the scriptures that follows the raised on the third day, according to the scriptures in that little creedal statement, must refer to all of the promises of the eternal Son of David.
Right.
And in particular, Psalms about God not letting...
the Holy One see corruption.
Yeah. And the reason we know it must refer to that is because we have in the preaching of Acts and elsewhere, these are the passages that preachers like Paul and Peter used. So they must be the passages that are referred to in this little creed. So these poor little pagans in Corinth had a giant task, and they just had to put up with it. This is, to be a Christian, you got to know all this stuff. You got to know the story and the backstory.
Yeah. So you have to know what you believe, which is the theological content, and also why you believe it. This was fulfilled in our day, seen by eyewitnesses. Otherwise, Paul says, as he continues in that text from 1 Corinthians 15, if this didn't really happen, then we're all of men most to be pitied.
Yeah. So the amount of information the early Christians had, I think, is underestimated by skeptical folks, but I think well appreciated by those who have a more historical sensibility.
So let's go back full circle to the place we started from. you've been talking about the kind of knowledge this creed is assuming the young catechumen there in Corinth would need to know as he's reading and interacting with this kind of early Christian material. But what does that say about us? Do you think we, modern Christians around the world, whether in Australia or the States, are we prepared to know what we believe and why we believe it? Do we have adequate knowledge of our Old Testament texts, or are we just kind of living in a happy, therapeutic kind of thing?
I can answer it by saying I feel often rebuked by what was expected of the first Christians in terms of their knowledge and so on. And yes, what was also demanded was a living faith, a willingness to suffer for Christ, a call to care for the poor, a call to promote the gospel, however you can, all these things that we recognize. But I do think in some Christian traditions today, we have lost the far more serious intellectual exercise involved in being a Christian. And that is learning back to front the core of the faith, which is what's in the Gospels, and learning the backstory to that, which is our Old Testament scriptures, and seeing how Christ is the fulfillment of that, and doing it as basic discipleship. So not rushing into, you know, five tips on tithing, you know, sort of practical yeah. stuff. No, it really seems that what the New Testament demanded of disciples, and let's just pause to recognize that the word disciple simply means student. It is the word for a student. What was demanded of disciples was a pretty thorough knowledge of the Old Testament plot, of some Old Testament details, particularly those around David and their fulfillment in Jesus Christ, the memorizing of gospel material, as well as all those other more practical things. And when I read some of the early Christian sort of preached material that we have, whether it's in the Apostolic Fathers toward the end of the first century, beginning of the second century, or into the catechetical lectures of Cyril of Jerusalem in the 300s, I do feel really quite rebuked. The subtlety of their allusions to Old Testament passages, the stuff that the disciples listening were expected to know, not just about Jesus, but about the Old Testament, leaves me thinking, wow, have I, who've spent a lot of time also as a teacher in a church, have I made that expectation of my congregations? And have I helped them through my preaching know with subtlety, not just the therapeutic nature of the gospel, not just how you can outdo Richard Dawkins on this particular apologetic issue or that, but have I helped them understand the Old Testament as it's fulfilled in Christ?
Hmm.
I keep coming back to the fact that Paul expected a 17-year-old in Corinth to do this hard work of memorization of Jesus' material, of understanding the Old Testament. Are we not capable of rising to the level of a first century 17-year-old pagan?
Hmm.
Have we dropped the bar so low that we can't even reach to that standard? It seems to me deeply troubling. And I think one of the reasons the church, the early church, was so big on catechesis, or hours of learning of this material, was they knew that only a depth of knowledge of the truth of Christ, as it's found in the Old Testament and the New Testament, will sustain Christians through persecution.
Hmm.
You might win people with the candy in happy times, but if you want Christians to maintain the faith amidst very serious pressure, which the early Christians faced at various times, it's only a depth of knowledge that is the grounding that can hold you firm in those times. I think that's partly what was behind their insistence on depth of learning.
Folks, you've been hearing from John Dixon, who teaches at the University of Sydney and is the author of Is Jesus History? John also hosts a podcast of his own titled Undeceptions, which you should check out when you get a chance. John Dixon, thanks for taking the time to join us on the White Horse Inn.
Really nice to chat with you. Thanks.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.